Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
Who is the Pope? He is the Emperor of Rome. Rome never died, never faded away. It became the Vatican. It is the priesthood of all of the old pagan religions of Rome, built upon the deception that they are Christian.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. This week, realpolitik, how prime ministers are really appointed at elections by the people or by the superpowers and faceless officials behind the scenes. US State Department official Victoria Nuland shoots her mouth off and then shoots to fame after being as disparaging as it's possible to be about the European Union. It happened during a leaked phone conversation with her ambassador to the Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt. She was explaining who she wanted to be the next Prime Minister of Ukraine when she revealed the new Prime Minister would be endorsed by Joe Biden in the United States and the United Nations, with no say whatsoever by the Ukrainian people. Also, the first really comprehensive interview with former CIA operative, private contractor and NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, done by German television, still not aired here in the UK. In it, he explains just how powerful private interests have become here in the UK and US, effectively privatising our secret state behind the backs of Parliament, press and public alike. And we have it here in full. But before all that, February is frack free for campaigners across Somerset and around the region, and I'm joined on the line now by Alex Hart in Frome. Hi Alex, welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, thank you for inviting me to speak.
That's absolutely fine, any time Alex, but what about the fracking scare stories? We're all after getting cheaper jet fuel and stuff from the United States, for example, because of fracking in the United States. Why not here?
Well, why anywhere? Why not anywhere? It's a terrifying process that's been created in a desperate attempt to just get more out of our planet, where possibly we really shouldn't be getting anything else out. And why should we be scared? Many reasons. The amount of water that's used, pumped into the ground and polluted. Perhaps the amount of traffic we're going to have on the roads would be one to for people who live in villages to think of.
Now, there are some scare stories. I mean, I don't know if they're real or not. Maybe you can help us out here. What about, I mean, we heard up in Blackpool earthquakes. Were they actually linked to the fracking?
Yes. And Quadrilla had to admit that that really was the case.
Radiation, apparently, coming to the surface. How on earth does that happen? That sounds rather nasty, that one.
Well, we've got what they call naturally occurring radioactive material, or NORM, and it's just in our earth. When you pump the water, they drill very deep down, kilometres under the down into the ground. And when you pump water that far down, it picks up this radiation. And then the water is irradiated. And no one really knows how to get that out. It doesn't get cleaned out in a sewage work, that's for sure.
OK, what about poisoning the water supply? Because I've seen film on YouTube from the United States of people setting fire to the water as it's coming out of their taps. It's got so much inflammable material in it. Now, that sounds immediately dangerous. The last thing you really want is having that kind of inflammable material when, you know, water is normally there to put out a fire, not to start it.
Yeah, it's scary, isn't it? So the methane that they're trying to actually get for us, for our gas, will then, you can imagine if the fracking is actually cracking open the rock, which opens fissures, who knows in which direction, and then the gases can escape and get into our water supplies, or our, I've forgotten the word for them, where the water's kept.
Oh, right, well, the aquifers.
Aquifers.
Okay, and into the water table. Now, that really is extremely worrying. We had a campaign about 18 months ago about the prospect of people dumping asbestos down around near Chew Valley Lake, and there was an absolute furore over that.
Yeah.
But I wonder, is that more or less dangerous than the idea of these fracking chemicals and the radiation getting into our water?
Yeah, they're equally scary. What I think is very scary, what's been happening to people in Australia and America who live near fracking sites, is that the methane's not just getting into the water, but it's actually escaping into their environment, and it's odourless. So people are inhaling it, and it's making people ill. You can end up with headaches and nosebleeds, and some people are getting extremely ill. It can, when it's in your water as well, it can burn your skin, and animals, livestock are dying too. And I'm amazed that the government will deny that this is the case.
So how is the discussion and debate going at the top levels in Westminster about whether this is a good technology or a bad technology? You know, who is sort of the players and how are they getting on?
Well, it's difficult. They're not able to be objective, as they all have links. Not all. A lot of them have links to the very companies that stand to gain from fracking.
Hang on, that's a bit of an accusation. Have you got any examples? You got any evidence of that?
Okay, well, we can start with Lord Brown. He's a very well-known chap. He's in the Cabinet Office. He has the authority to appoint fracking and fossil fuel chums into government departments and Treasury. And he's the chairman of Quadrilla and the finance company financing Quadrilla.
Hang on, he was the boss of BP and then he had to resign, as I remember.
Yeah, not a very good track record.
What about Peter Lilly?
Peter Lilly, now he has been on TV absolutely denying that he has any links whatsoever. But he does. He's one of the only three MPs to have voted against the Climate Change Act. He's a climate sceptic and then happens to be the non-executive board member of Tethys Petroleum, a Cayman Island-based oil and gas drilling company. He gets quite a lot of money from that.
Now, we also had Lord Green up until recently in the Cabinet. He was obviously never actually elected to the role. He's made a Lord and then just stuck in the Cabinet. But he was also, not only, as I understand, he's got some sort of involvement with fracking, but he was also the chairman of HSBC. I mean, we were talking in the first hour about the massive money laundering going on with the Sinaloa drug cartel in Mexico, one of the most murderous gangs in the world. This guy was running around their cash in his HSBC arm vans, and he was also in charge of HSBC when they adapted their banks over in Mexico so that there were big hatches so they could take suitcases. I mean, these guys, I mean, what is Lord Green's actual links to fracking, if he has any?
Well, there's the HSBC who funds a lot of fracking. He's also a non-executive director at BASF, which supplies the fracking industry with materials and the things they need.
Okay, I know also one of our local Conservative MPs, Jacob Rees-Mogg, is supposed to be quite a supporter. Is that the case?
Yes, he really thinks that it's going to offer employment to people in his local constituency.
Well, maybe in the security industry?
Quite possibly, though a lot of G4S, I've been to a couple of fracking sites, and you were using Gurkhas, G4S Gurkhas. Yeah, I'm not saying they're not local, but I really can't see a lot of jobs going to the local people.
Okay, Alex. Now, what areas in Somerset and around surrounding areas do we need to be focused on? Whereabouts is this likely to happen?
Well, I don't want to be NIMBY, but it is helpful, isn't it, when people realise it's actually going to be next to them. And without wanting to scaremonger, the government are granting petroleum exploration development licences to over 60% of our country. We'll have these pedal licences, as they're called.
But, I mean, are there any hot spots in Somerset where the... I mean, I know the Mendips is supposed to be, or some places in the Mendips are supposed to be, where these big fracking companies have got on their maps big red crosses. We want to frack here.
Yes. There are a few places. We managed to scare UK Methane away from Keynsham a couple of years ago. That was exciting. I think they realise, when they realise that a community is aware of what's going on, they know it's going to be harder for them to go in. So Somerset's managed to prove itself quite aware. But yes, they've looked at
Stoneaston.
Stoneaston,
yep.
Yes, near Radstock, that area, all the places where mining used to occur.
Okay. Now, tell us a little bit about your organisation and what events you're planning through February.
Well, this is our second Frack-Free February. We did one last year. It was very successful, and it's helpful for people to just get informed, isn't it? And people who are already concerned can chat to other people and get good ideas of how to stand up against it. We draw inspiration from across the world as well. We have connections with people who are fighting it in other countries, which is really great. So if you would like to know more, what would I recommend? Ooh, well, we've got film showings and meetings and discussions going on in Congressbury on the 11th, West Harptree on the 12th. The Little Theatre Cinema in Bath is going to be showing The Truth Behind the Dash for Gas on Monday the 17th, 8:15. Langport Film Showing and Meeting on Friday the 21st. Chilcompton on Sunday the 23rd, Film Showing and Meeting. Monday the 24th, we've got Polton Village, Film Showing and Meeting. These are all in the evening. Bruton on Tuesday the 25th. Thursday the 27th at Bath Spa University College, Newton St Low. That's 6 p.m. till 8 p.m. And most excitingly, on Wednesday, we're having this is a big event. People have worked very hard on this. It's How Could Fracking Affect Farming, and it's an information evening for local food producers and landowners. And this is at Wells Town Hall, Wednesday the 26th of February at 7 o'clock. Booking is encouraged, but we've invited about 800 people, landowners across Somerset. They've all been personally invited by a letter to come and join a public meeting. And we will have a Green MEP, Jose Bove, speaking to us via Skype. And he successfully stopped fracking in his country, in his area in France. And as you might know, France now have a moratorium. They will not frack.
Fascinating stuff. Thanks for a really amazing amount of work you seem to be doing. And it's just actually right down there on the ground. Now, whereabouts can we make contact with you online and find you online or elsewhere? Maybe if people aren't on the internet, are there any way to get hold of you, Alex?
So if you are on the internet, you can find out all the information about the gigs. We've got creative events as well. We've got training and workshops. We've got demos planned. Go to www.frackfreesomerset.org. If you aren't on the internet, then get yourself... There'll be posters up in all the places that will be showing the films. So look out for posters. Talk to people. Our network's growing ever so quickly. So I'm sure... if you talk to enough people, you'll find someone who can help you out and introduce you to an event. Is that helpful? Oh, and there's a benefit gig on in Froome.
Oh, even better, right, in Froome.
On the 7th of March, yeah, we're going to be dancing against... it's a benefit gig. We've got Funk and Soul, two live bands, the All Nighters and Fat Stanley. Lots of fun. So, yeah, you can also have fun meeting up with like-minded people.
Alex Hart, thanks ever so much for stepping in at the last minute and giving us a fantastic rundown of everything that's going on in fracking-free Somerset. Thanks very much.
Thank you for your time.
And now, that was Alex Hart there from Froome. Now, we're going to go over to really pretty much an exclusive interview. I mean, it's there on the internet. It was, anyway. I looked again this morning, and it had gone because it said too many viewings. This is an interview by the German TV networks with, or a German TV network with Edward Snowden. It's pretty comprehensive. It's pretty long. But afterwards, Martin and I will be discussing it. So here we now have the first really comprehensive interview with former CIA operative, private contractor and NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, where he raises some very serious questions about the privatisation behind the backs of Parliament, press and public of our security services.
Well, the last couple of nights, because I was reading that you asked for a kind of police protection, are there any threats?
There are significant threats, but I sleep very well. There was an article that came out in an online outlet called BuzzFeed, where they interviewed officials from the Pentagon, from the National Security Agency, and they gave them anonymity to be able to say what they wanted. And what they told the reporter was that they wanted to murder me. These individuals, and these are acting government officials, they said they would be happy, they would love to put a bullet in my head, to... poison me as I was returning from the grocery store and have me die in the shower.
But fortunately, you're still alive with us.
Right, but I'm still alive. And I don't lose sleep because I've done what I feel I needed to do. It was the right thing to do, and I'm not going to be afraid.
The greatest fear I have, and I quote you, regarding these disclosures is nothing will change. That was one of your greatest concerns at the time. But in the meantime, there is a vivid discussion about the situation with the NSA, not only in America, but also in Germany and in Brazil. And President Obama was forced to go public and to justify what the NSA was doing on legal grounds.
What we saw initially in response to the revelations was sort of a circling of the wagons of government around the National Security Agency. Instead of circling around the public and protecting their rights, the political class circled around the security state and protected their rights. What's interesting is, though that was the initial response, since then, we've seen a softening. We've seen the president acknowledge that when he first said, we've drawn the right balance, there are no abuses. We've seen him and his officials admit that there have been abuses. There have been thousands of violations of the National Security Agency and other agencies' authorities every single year.
Is the speech of Obama recently the beginning of a serious regulation?
It was clear from the president's speech that he wanted to make minor changes to preserve authorities that we don't need. The president created a review board from officials that were personal friends, from national security insiders, former deputy of the CIA, people who had every incentive to be soft on these programs and to see them in the best possible light. But what they found was that these programs have no value. They've never stopped a terrorist attack in the United States. And they have marginal utility at best for other things. The only thing that the Section 215 phone metadata program, actually it's a broader metadata program, a bulk collection means mass surveillance program, was in stopping or detecting an $8,500 wire transfer from a cab driver in California. And it's this kind of review where insiders go, we don't need these programs. These programs don't make us safe. They take a tremendous amount of resources to run, and they offer us no value. They go, we can modify these. The National Security Agency operates under the president's executive authority alone. He can end or modify or direct a change in their policies at any time.
For the first time, President Obama did concede that the NSA collects and stores trillions of data.
Every time you pick up the phone, dial a number, write an email, make a purchase, travel on the bus carrying a cell phone, swipe a card somewhere, you leave a trace. And the government has decided that it's a good idea to collect it all, everything, even if you've never been suspected of any crime. Traditionally, the government would identify a suspect, they would go to a judge, they would say, we suspect he's committed this crime, they would get a warrant, and then they would be able to use the totality of their powers in pursuit of the investigation. Nowadays, what we see is they want to apply the totality of their powers in advance, prior to an investigation.
You started this debate. Edward Snowden is, in the meantime, a household name for the whistleblower in the age of the Internet. You were working till last summer for the NSA, and during this time you collected secretly thousands of confidential documents. What was the decisive moment, or was there a long period of time or something happening? Why did you do this?
I would say sort of the breaking point is seeing the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, directly lie under oath to Congress. There's no saving an intelligence community that believes it can lie to the public and the legislators who need to be able to trust it and regulate its actions. Seeing that really meant for me there was no going back. Beyond that, it was the creeping realization that no one else was going to do this. The public had a right to know about these programs. The public had a right to know that which the government is doing in its name and that which the government is doing against the public. But neither of these things we were allowed to discuss, we were allowed to know. Even the wider body of our elected representatives were prohibited from knowing or discussing these programs, and that's a dangerous thing. The only review we had was from a secret court, the FISA court, which is a sort of rubber stamp authority. When you are on the inside, when you go into work every day, when you sit down at the desk and you realize the power you have, you can wiretap the President of the United States. You can wiretap a federal judge. And if you do it carefully, no one will ever know, because the only way the NSA discovers abuses are from self-reporting.
We are not talking only of the NSA as far as this is concerned. There is a multilateral agreement for cooperation among the services. And this alliance of intelligence operations is known as the Five Eyes. What agencies and countries belong to this alliance, and what is its purpose?
The Five Eyes alliance is sort of an artifact of the post-World War II era, where the Anglophone countries of the major powers banded together to sort of cooperate and share the costs of intelligence gathering infrastructure. So we have the UK's GCHQ, we have the US NSA, we have Canada's CSEC, we have the Australian Signals Intelligence Directorate, and we have New Zealand's DSD. What the result of this was over decades and decades was sort of a supranational intelligence organization that doesn't answer to the laws of its own countries.
In many countries, as in America too, the agencies like the NSA are not allowed to spy within their own borders on their own people. So the Brits, for example, they can spy on everybody but the Brits. But the NSA can conduct surveillance in England. So at the very end, they could exchange their data and it would be, they would be strictly following the law.
If you asked the governments about this directly, they would deny it and point to policy agreements between the members of the Five Eyes, saying that they won't spy on each other's citizens. But there are a couple key points there. One is that the way they define spying is not the collection of data. The GCHQ is collecting an incredible amount of data on British citizens, just as the National Security Agency is gathering an enormous amount of data on U.S. citizens. What they're saying is that they will not then target people within that data. They won't look for UK citizens or British citizens. In addition, the policy agreements between them that say British won't target US citizens, US won't target British citizens, are not legally binding. The actual memorandums of agreement state specifically on that, that they're not intended to put a legal restriction on any government. They're policy agreements that can be deviated from or broken at any time. So if they want to spy on a British citizen, they can spy on a British citizen. And then they can even share that data with the British government that is itself forbidden from spying on UK citizens. So there is a sort of a trading dynamic there, but it's not open. It's more of a nudge and a wink. And beyond that, the key is to remember that the surveillance and the abuse doesn't occur when people look at the data. It occurs when people gather the data in the first place.
How narrow is the cooperation of the German Secret Service, BND, with the NSA and the Five Eyes?
I would describe it as intimate. As a matter of fact, the first way I described it in a written interview was that the German services and the U.S. services are in bed together. They not only share information, the reporting, the results from intelligence, but they actually share the tools and the infrastructure. They work together against joint targets and services. And there's a lot of danger in this. One of the major programs that faces abuse in the National Security Agency is what's called X-KeyScore. It's a front-end search engine that allows them to look through all of the records they collect through worldwide every day.
What could you do if you would sit, so to speak, on their place with this kind of instrument?
You could read anyone's email in the world. Anybody you've got an email address for, any website you can watch traffic to and from, any computer that an individual sits at, you can watch it. Any laptop that you're tracking, you can follow it as it moves from place to place throughout the world. It's a one-stop shop for access to the NSA's information. And what's more, you can tag individuals using X-KeyScore, where, let's say I saw you once, and I thought what you were doing was interesting, or you just have access that's interesting to me. Let's say you work at a major German corporation, and I want access to that network. I can track your username on a website, on a forum somewhere. I can track your real name. I can track associations with your friends. And I can build what's called a fingerprint, which is network activity unique to you, which means anywhere you go in the world, anywhere you try to sort of hide your online presence, hide your identity, the NSA can find you. And anyone who's allowed to use this, or who the NSA shares the software with, can do the same thing. Germany is one of the countries that has access to XKeyscore.
It sounds rather frightening. The question is, does the BND deliver data of Germans to the NSA?
Whether the BND does it directly or knowingly, the NSA gets German data. Whether it's provided, I can't speak to until it's been reported, because it would be classified. And I prefer that journalists make the distinctions and the decisions about what is public interest and what should be published. However, it's no secret that every country in the world has the data of their citizens in the NSA. Millions and millions and millions of data connections from Germans going about their daily lives, talking on their cell phones, sending SMS messages, visiting websites, buying things online. All of this ends up at the NSA. And it's reasonable to suspect that the BND may be aware of it in some capacity. Now, whether or not they actively provide the information, I should not say.
The BND basically argues, if we do this accidentally, actually, and our filter didn't work.
Right. So the kind of things that they're discussing there are two things. They're talking about filtering of ingest, which means when the NSA puts a secret server in a German telecommunications provider, or they hack a German router and they divert the traffic in a manner that lets them search through things, they're saying, if I see what I think is a German talking to another German, I'll drop it. But how do you know? You could say, well, these people are speaking the German language. This IP address seems to be from a German company to another German company, but that's not accurate, and they wouldn't dump all of that traffic, because they'll get people who are targets of interest, who are actively in Germany using German communications. So realistically, what's happening is, when they say there's no spying on Germans, they don't mean that German data isn't being gathered. They don't mean that records aren't being taken or stolen. What they mean is that they're not intentionally searching for German citizens. And that's sort of a fingers crossed behind the back promise. It's not reliable.
What's about other European countries like Norway and Sweden, for example? Because we have a lot of, I think, underwater cables going through the Baltic Sea.
So this is sort of an expansion of the same idea. If the NSA isn't collecting information on German citizens in Germany, are they as soon as it leaves German borders? And the answer is yes. Any single communication that transits the internet, the NSA may intercept at multiple points. They might see it in Germany, they might see it in Sweden, they might see it in Norway or Finland, they might see it in Britain, and they might see it in the United States. Any single one of these places that a German communication crosses, it'll be ingested and added to the database.
So let's come to our southern European neighbors then. What's about Italy? What's about France? What's about Spain?
It's the same deal worldwide.
Does the NSA spy on Siemens, on Mercedes, on other successful German companies, for example, to prevail, to have the advantage of knowing what is going on in the scientific and the economic world?
I don't want to preempt the editorial decisions of journalists.
Okay.
But what I will say is, there's no question that the U.S. is engaged in economic spying. If there's information at Siemens that they think would be beneficial to the national interests, not the national security of the United States, they'll go after that information and they'll take it.
There is this old saying, you do whatever you can do. So the NSA is doing whatever is technically possible.
This is something that the president touched on last year, where he said, just because we can do something, and this was in relation to tapping Angela Merkel's phone, just because we can do something doesn't mean that we should. And that's exactly what's happened. The technological capabilities that have been provided because of sort of weak security standards in internet protocols and cellular communications networks have meant that intelligence services can create systems that see everything.
Nothing annoyed the German government more than the fact that the NSA taped the private phone of the German Chancellor Merkel over the last 10 years, obviously. Suddenly, this invisible surveillance was connected with a known face and was not connected with a kind of watery, shady terrorist background. Obama now promised to stop snooping on Merkel, which raises the question, did the NSA tape already previous governments in Germany, previous chancellors, and when did they do that, and how long did they do this for?
This is a particularly difficult question for me to answer, because there's information that I very strongly believe is in the public interest. However, as I've said before, I prefer for journalists to make those decisions in advance, review the material themselves, and decide whether or not the public value of this information outweighs the sort of reputational cost to the officials that ordered the surveillance. What I can say is we know Angela Merkel was monitored by the National Security Agency. The question is, how reasonable is it to assume that she is the only German official that was monitored? How reasonable is it to believe that she's the only prominent German face who the National Security Agency was watching? I would suggest it seems unreasonable that if anyone was concerned about the intentions of German leadership, that they would only watch Merkel and not her aides, not other prominent officials, not heads of ministries, or even local government officials.
How does a young man from Elizabeth City in North Carolina, 30 years old, get in such a position in such a sensitive area?
That's a very difficult question to answer. In general, I would say it highlights the dangers of privatizing government functions. I worked previously as an actual staff officer, a government employee for the Central Intelligence Agency. But I've also served much more frequently as a contractor in a private capacity. What that means is you have private for-profit companies doing inherently governmental work, like targeted espionage, surveillance, compromising foreign systems. And anyone who has the skills, who can convince a private company that they have the qualifications to do so, will be empowered by the government to do that. And there's very little oversight. There's very little review.
Have you been one of these classical computer kids, sitting red-eyed during the nights in the age of 12, 15, and your father was knocking on your door and saying, switch off the light, it's too late now? Did you get your computer skills from that side, or how did it work? When did you get your first computer?
Right. I definitely have had a deep informal education in computers and electronic technology. They've always been fascinating and interesting to me. the characterization of having your parents telling you to go to bed, I would say, is fair.
If one looks to the little public data of your life, one discovers that you obviously wanted to join in May 2004 the special forces to fight in Iraq. What did motivate you at the time? You know, special forces looking at you in the very moment means grim fighting, and it means probably killing. And did you ever get to Iraq?
No, I didn't get to Iraq. One of the interesting things about these special forces are that they're not actually intended for direct combat. They're what's referred to as a force multiplier. They're inserted behind enemy lines. It's a squad that has a number of different specialties in it, and they teach and enable the local population to resist or to support U.S. forces in a way that allows the local population a chance to help determine their own destiny. And I felt that was an inherently noble thing at the time. In hindsight, some of the reasons that we went into Iraq were not well-founding, and I think did a disservice to everyone involved.
What happened to your adventure then? Did you stay long with them, or what happened to you?
No, I broke my legs when I was in training and was discharged.
So it was a short adventure, in other words. In 2007, the CIA stationed you with a diplomatic cover in Geneva, in Switzerland. Why did you join the CIA, by the way?
I don't think I can actually answer that one.
Okay, if it's what you have been doing there, forget it, but why did you join the CIA?
In many ways, I think it's a continuation of trying to do everything I could to prosecute the public good in the most effective way. And it's in line with the rest of my government service, where I tried to use my technical skills in the most difficult positions I could find in the world, and the CIA offered that.
If we look back, Special Forces, CIA, NSA, it's not actually the description of a human rights activist or somebody who becomes a whistleblower afterwards. What happens to you?
I think it tells a story, and that's no matter how deeply an individual is embedded in the government, no matter how faithful to the government they are, no matter how strongly they believe in the causes of their government, as I did during the Iraq War, people can learn, people can discover the line between appropriate government behavior and actual wrongdoing. And I think it became clear to me that that line had been crossed.
You worked for the NSA through a private contractor with the name Booz Allen Hamilton, one of the big ones in the business. What is the advantage for the US government or the CIA to work through a private contractor to outsource a central government function?
Contracting culture of the national security community in the United States is a complex topic. It's driven by a number of interests between primarily limiting the number of direct government employees, at the same time as keeping lobbying groups in Congress, typically from very well-funded businesses, such as Booz Allen Hamilton. The problem there is you end up in a situation where government policies are being influenced by private corporations who have interests that are completely divorced from the public good in mind. The result of that is what we saw at Booz Allen Hamilton, where you have private individuals who have access to what the government alleges were millions and millions of records that they could walk out the door with at any time with no accountability, no oversight, no auditing. The government didn't even know they were gone.
At the very end, you ended up in Russia. Many of the intelligence community suspect you made a deal, classified material for asylum here in Russia.
The chief of the task force investigating me, as recently as December, said that their investigation had turned up no evidence or indications at all that I had any outside help or contact or had made a deal of any kind to accomplish my mission. I worked alone. I didn't need anybody's help. I don't have any ties to foreign governments. I'm not a spy for Russia or China or any other country for that matter. If I am a traitor, who did I betray? I gave all of my information to the American public, to American journalists who were reporting on American issues. If they see that as treason, I think people really need to consider who do they think they're working for. The public is supposed to be their boss, not their enemy. Beyond that, as far as my personal safety, I'll never be fully safe until these systems have changed.
After your revelations, none of the European countries really offered you asylum. Where did you apply in Europe for asylum?
I can't remember the list of countries with any specificity, because there were many of them. But France, Germany were definitely in there, as was the UK. A number of European countries, all of whom, unfortunately, felt that doing the right thing was less important than supporting U.S. political concerns.
One reaction to the NSA snooping is, in the very moment, that countries like Germany are thinking to create national internets, an attempt to force internet companies to keep their data in their own country. Does this work?
it's not going to stop the NSA, let's put it that way. The NSA goes where the data is. If the NSA can pull text messages out of telecommunication networks in China, they can probably manage to get Facebook messages out of Germany. Ultimately, the solution to that is not to try to stick everything in a walled garden, although that does raise the level of sophistication and complexity of taking the information. It's also much better simply to secure the information internationally against everyone rather than playing let's move the data. Moving the data isn't fixing the problem. Securing the data is the problem.
President Obama, in the very moment, obviously doesn't care too much about the message of the leak. And together with the NSA, they do care very much more about catching the messenger in that context. Obama asked the Russian president several times to extradite you, but did not. It looks that you will stay till the rest of your life probably in Russia. How do you feel about Russia in that context? And is there a solution to this problem?
I think it's becoming increasingly clear that these leaks didn't cause harm. In fact, they serve the public good. Because of that, I think it'll be very difficult to maintain sort of an ongoing campaign of persecution against someone who the public agrees serves the public interest.
The New York Times wrote a very long comment and demanded clemency for you. The headline, Edward Snowden whistleblower, and I quote from that. The public learned in great detail how the agency has extended its mandate and abused its authority. And the New York Times closes. President Obama should tell his aides to begin finding a way to end Mr. Snowden's vilification and give him an incentive to return home. Did you get a call in between from the White House?
I've never received a call from the White House, and I'm not waiting by the phone. But I would welcome the opportunity to talk about how we can bring this to a conclusion that serves the interests of all parties. I think it's clear there are times where what is lawful is distinct from what is rightful. There are times throughout history, and it doesn't take long for either an American or a German to think about times in the history of their country where the law provided the government to do things which were not right.
President Obama obviously is, in the very moment, not quite convinced of that. Because he said you are charged with three felonies, and I quote, if you, Edward Snowden, believe in what you did, you should go back to America, appear before the court with a lawyer and make your case. Is this the solution?
It's interesting because he mentions three felonies. What he doesn't say is that the crimes that he's charged me with are crimes that don't allow me to make my case. They don't allow me to defend myself in an open court to the public and convince a jury that what I did was to their benefit. The Espionage Act was never intended, it's from 1918, it was never intended to prosecute journalistic sources, people who are informing the newspapers about information that's of public interest. It was intended for people who are selling documents in secret to foreign governments, who are bombing bridges, who are sabotaging communications, not people who are serving the public good. So it's, I would say, illustrative that the president would choose to say someone should face the music when he knows the music is a show trial.
Edward Snowden, thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you.
Yes, and that was aired on German television, that interview with the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden just last Sunday, still not here in the UK. Martin, I mean, he's raising some pretty explosive issues there, particularly when he's talking about the same private companies that are being contracted into being part of the intelligence services at the NSA, such as the one he worked for, are actually also involved at massive scale in lobbying too. That there is this kind of circle between private security and government, which is almost impossible, it seems, maybe now, to break.
Yes, it is. And it's, there should not be any kind of private interest involved in espionage and Secret Service activity. The problem being, of course, once people are making a profit out of what they're doing for the government, they then start to influence government policy in the directions they want it to go. And it's the military-industrial complex at work. Now, if a society, when it sets up a Secret Service or its military or whatever, has to have a dead weight loss so that every penny, every dollar that you spend on it is not going to make any profit for anybody, then people really consider about how much of it they actually want. But when you've got a situation where a large chunk of your economy and lots of private interests are bound up with producing weaponry, with producing secret services, then of course you've got a real problem, because they then push for more weaponry, push for more secret services. And in actual fact, you know, the free market economist Milton Friedman pointed this out a long time ago: once government subsidises certain kinds of activities, those people are then in a position to keep coming back to the government and say, we want more of your money. And don't forget, people are making a private profit out of war, out of espionage, and out of things which basically, in any rational world, to my mind, should be run entirely in the public interest, with no private interest involved whatsoever.
Well, what about the point he's making there to do with the vast number of different types of government officials who are being put under surveillance? I mean, we're hearing things like, for example, judges, these kinds of characters. There's very little checks and balances, it seems, on who is under surveillance and who isn't, including maybe, for example, chairman of a political party.
Well, indeed. And, of course, what, if you're collecting dirt on everybody, that means you're then in a position to blackmail politicians, are you not? We are attacking country X because we know that you're having sex with little boys and you aren't going to argue.
Well, we're talking here about lawyers, surgeons, doctors, jurors, journalists, judges, newspaper editors, elected politicians, priests, military officers.
Yes. And the point is, it's very, very like the setup in East Germany before the fall of the wall or whatever. Everybody is being watched, and because they know they're being watched, they know that they've got to toe the line with what the policy is. And don't forget, the policy is being driven by very wealthy people embedded in the banking system, embedded in the multinational companies like British Aerospace, which produce weaponry which kills people. And all of that is actually done for private profit. It's completely wrong. Arms industries, police forces, all of these things should be completely non-profit.
Okay, the other issue, a massive one, is that of trust. Now, with our secret services, MI5, MI6, GCHQ, any other services that we don't necessarily know about, those are the three main ones we do. Now, they do rely massively on getting the trust of the public, the trust of the politicians, the trust of the judicial system, and it seems that what's happened here is that they've now been exposed to have been abusing that trust for decades.
Yes, and of course the real payoff is going to be when it comes to negotiations on trade treaties, for example, between the EU and the United States. I think it's quite possible the German government are going to say, well, if you're going to bug our trade delegation's phones, then we're not going to negotiate with you, and you can whistle for your deal. That's what's going to happen. It's going to unravel all of those trade deals.
Well, one thing which is particularly worrying about this is the move towards everyone being a target. And, of course, that was something which was really started in the terms of databases by the Nazis back in 1933, when the Final Solution, according to Edwin Black, the author of IBM and the Holocaust, sought to efficiently transport Jews out of European ghettos along railroad lines and into death camps, with timing precise so that the victims were able to walk right out of a boxcar into a waiting gas chamber if necessary. The coordination was a complex task. This too called for a computer, but in 1933 no computer existed, he says. However, another invention did exist, the IBM punch card and card sorting system, a precursor to the computer. IBM, primarily through its German subsidiary, made Hitler's program of Jewish destruction a technological mission the company pursued with chilling success. IBM Germany, using its own staff and equipment, designed, executed and supplied the indispensable technological assistance Hitler's Third Reich needed to accomplish what had never been done before, the automation of human destruction. Now, do you think I'm stretching a point here to compare the mass database that Hitler began to collect in 1933 with the help of IBM and the mass database that's going being put together by GCHQ, NSA, through these mass data trawls?
Well, the point is, what do you do with the data when you've got it? I mean, authoritarian systems have always wanted to collect information on people. Stalin's Russia would be very similar. The point is that, in theory, there's supposed to be... the US Constitution is very clear that, that you're only allowed to actually interfere with people's private business, looking at their letters, as it was back in the 18th century, if you've got a legitimate reason to suspect them of some crime. Otherwise, it's illegal. And any attempt to just trawl is illegal. And anybody who's been involved in trawling has got to realise, if we say to people, if you break the law, you are going to go to prison. Now, you have been breaking the law. GCHQ has been breaking the law. It's quite clear that the new snoopers charter, which got knocked back by Parliament, they were coming to actually ask, could they carry on doing what they were doing already? Now, what they've got to understand is there's no legal basis for that. If there's no legal basis for it, it's illegal. Now, we either have a rule of law or we don't. And, of course, the other real problem is that Western intelligence services are implicated as terrorists, not just as snoopers. And that's a real problem. We need the police force to sort that one out.
I think probably the reason why the law is there is because of historical misuse of this database information. As I was saying, for example, there by Hitler's regime in the 1930s. Anyway, we've heard this week, time for offensive GCHQ to defend itself in the courts, according to Open Enterprise blog by Glyn Moody. Secret British spy unit has created to mount cyber attacks on Britain's enemies, has been waging war on activists at Anonymous and Lulzsec. And some of those activists, Martin, have been going to court, going to jail, and yet the people who are actually launching those illegal cyber attacks on those activists' forums are actually GCHQ themselves.
Well, yes, I mean, if they're allowed to go around hacking people's emails and doing denial of service attacks, but you're not. Now, in actual fact, all of this is illegal. And as I come back to my further point, it's not just that they're snoopers. Edward Snowden's missed the point here. The bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980 was carried out by NATO intelligence services. So was the Bortmann Beer Hall massacre in Germany. In other words, they are not just eavesdroppers. They are also potentially and definitely proven to be terrorists, and that's the real problem. We need the police to get on top of this.
Okay, scrutiny of United States airbases in Britain is stuck in the 1950s, according to Tom Watson in The Guardian this week. On Wednesday, said almost all first impressions of RAF Croughton, small airbase that sits among green fields 20 miles northeast of the Prime Minister's Witney constituency, are misleading. From the road running out of the nearby Northamptonshire village from which it takes its name, it's visible as a series of anonymous barn-like buildings. He's making the point here, Martin, that we've got scores of US bases in Britain, some of which have been used for criminal activities such as killing people with drones and, as we've just been hearing, criminal spying.
Well, if they're still based in Britain, I would argue that those people should be arrested. The police should go in there and arrest those people. And in the longer term, of course, we should get rid of all US bases from Britain, as the French did in 1960.
The House of Lords have also recommended a complete review of the 50-year-old rules under which the US bases are operated here in Britain.
Well, yes, I mean, what are they? Who are they protecting us from exactly? Why are they here? Perhaps it's like they've got 130-odd bases around the world. Why do they need bases? Perhaps they should all just go home and spend the money on, I don't know, nice transport systems, nursery schools.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, deep embarrassment, and it's not only the West that's been spying, quite clearly. This definitely looks like the Russian Secret Service spying on some American diplomats here, and a leak, very embarrassing one that is, this week, to do with the Ukraine. Now, let's hear the two voices you're about to hear. One is US Department of State official Victoria Nuland, and the other is the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt. And here they are discussing who is going to be the new Prime Minister, because it seems they are the ones who are going to put a new Prime Minister in place rather than the Ukrainian people.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it. And, you know.
And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
The EU.
No, exactly. And again, the fact that this is out there right now, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why Yanukovych did that. But in the meantime, there's a Party of Regions faction meeting going on right now, and I'm sure there's a lively argument going on in that group at this point. But anyway, we could land jelly set up on this one if we move fast. So let me work on Klitschko, and if you can just keep, I think we want to try to get somebody with an international personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. And then the other issue is some kind of outreach to Yanukovych, but we probably regroup on that tomorrow as we see how things start to fall into place.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me VFR saying, you need Biden, and I said, probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great.
Okay, well, it'd be interesting to see, Martin, if what they say comes to pass. It seems that this is actually what goes on behind the scenes quite a lot in these sorts of situations, particularly where there's some sort of civil unrest, is that actually players are being put on the chessboard, maybe queens, kings, rooks moved around without the people getting involved at all.
Well, it's fairly clear what's going on, isn't it? They're trying to put their people in power in the Ukraine. And, of course, what's bizarre about this is that the ostensible reason for the protests in Ukraine is because of an association agreement with the EU. There's no prospect of EU membership for the Ukraine at the moment. It's a fantasy. The protesters must realise that, because there's no way whatsoever that people in Britain, for example, are going to take on millions of Ukrainians who are all going to arrive and take our jobs. It's just not going to happen. But at the same time, they're using it as a stick to beat Putin with, because they're not happy with what's happened in Syria and so forth.
Okay.
But they are manipulating away.
Okay, and Seamus Mills on a really interesting article in The Guardian all about the fascist element within some of these street protests. Anyway, time to sign off now. Time for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Cyrus the Virus, and hopefully up next, thanks to our guest in the first hour, Deputy Leader of Bristol City Council's Conservative Group, Mark Weston. I'm Tony Gosling, online at thisweek.org.uk. See you next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Is Bristol's BC FM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, David Cameron's described some of the flooding he's seen in Somerset as biblical. He's promised the government will commit all available resources to southwest England, which is at risk from fresh storms tonight. Fisherman Barry Young from Brixham in Devon says...